Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 301 of Registry Matters. Gentlemen, how are you? Larry, how are you this evening? You're getting older, aren't you?
About to turn 183.
183, wow. Chance, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm in awe of the wisdom of a 183-year-old.
He's up there. You're not 183. Are you even close? Are you even a third of his age?
Yeah, I'd say about exactly his age, but, you know, what can I tell you?
I'm with you. I don't know what to do with him. Make sure that you press like and subscribe and leave a 5-star review in all the places. And you can see there on the YouTube video. Oh, it's where is it? It's over there. Press like and subscribe and subscribe on your favorite podcast app, etc. All that. And if you're feeling generous, become a patron for as little as $1 a month. And you can join the community. You can hang out with us in Discord and all that fun stuff, because we have a lot of good conversations there. So with all that said, Larry, what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a listener comment at the beginning, and we're going to do a dive, possibly a deep dive, into the New York Court of Appeals decision to overturn Harvey Weinstein's conviction. And we have the California Corner with attorney Chance Oberstein. And we have three articles I'd like to cover.
Now, you know, based on the amount of content we have, I don't think we're getting to all three of them. I looked at this, Larry. This goes for like 47 pages.
Talk fast.
All right, I will talk fast. But literally before we get going, a friend of mine called me yesterday, and we have talked about him on the podcast before, but he went and took a polygraph yesterday, you know, 6-month, whatever it is, and he's got to drive all the way up to the city. He's not really comfortable driving up to the city. He's got to pay his $225, $250, whatever extortion fee they throw at you. And one of the questions caused him to sort of kind of bust out, not all the way laughing, but kind of like almost. And that, I guess, tripped up the machine. And so they say he failed his polygraph. And I wanted to know, we've talked, Larry, you and I have talked a million times about the polygraph, but I wanted to get Chance's opinion on the impact of it as far as his supervision. Are they going to then lock him up? Can they lock you up for a polygraph? All those things. What is your take on where things go from here?
Well, yeah, typically, no. They're not going to lock him up for that. Because basically, as you've probably discussed a million times, this isn't even evidence in a court of law. Right. What's going to happen probably is, you know, it's going to have to do with therapy, and it's going to have to do with resetting or applying more. You know, the process is the punishment. And so if you're on maintenance, you go back to group. If you're on group, you do more, that type of stuff. And obviously, I mean, from what you say, and if, you know, he was set off on one question, probably, you know, he failed the test. It doesn't test whether you're speaking the truth or not. It has to do with nerve. Galvanic nerve response. And when you're pissed off or angry, you don't do well in the test. It could be that you're nervous. It could be that you're nervous because the truth is out there and you can't deal with that because you know, that question makes you nervous about that. Or it could be that you've been asked the question so many times that the question is so ridiculous that your immediate response is anger. And that's going to cause a problem too. So there are different explanations for it, but bottom line is, no, it's going to have, the repercussion from that is more on the therapy side, not necessarily on the custodial punishment side.
For me, the polygraph is one of the things that drives me the most batty because there's no science behind it whatsoever. I'm all about some science and some evidence, and you probably don't know this, Chance, but one of the first episodes that Larry and I did was about the polygraph, and we almost broke out in a fight because Larry's like, no, this thing's real, it works, until he went and asked a friend of his that does the polygraph, and he's like, it's kind of about a little bit better than a coin flip.
Correct.
And it drives me absolutely bonkers. But if it intimidates you to where you admit to doing whatever you were doing, then I guess it did work. It just drives me absolutely bonkers.
Well, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. That's essentially what it's used for, is to shake the tree and hope that, you know, some apples fall out. And, you know, that's best and highest use of that technology.
Now, before we close out, and Larry, feel free, I want to ask you a question, Chance. Do you think that it would be advisable to buy a polygraph machine so that you could practice at home, so that when you do take the real test, you're better prepared for it?
No. I think the best way of dealing with that machine is finding someone who's familiar with it, and having a consultation with them. Perhaps someone who formerly gave those tests, or perhaps psychologists that have been involved with those tests. But your best investment in time is learning the reasons underlying why you can't pass it, and has nothing to do with working with a machine. You can do it a million times and you'll get the same result. So what you need is some good consulting with someone who knows what they're talking about.
Gotcha. Anything to add, Larry, before we go?
Well, I just think, I don't want to be too critical of the person who did that. That was a real life story. But if you were to have a polygraph in your home, a machine, and a probation officer came around to do a home visit and they were to discover it, do you think their reaction would be favorable?
No, not at all.
Well, that's what I was asking Chance. I mean, this is what happened. He got in some significant trouble for having a polygraph machine. They did not think that was as funny as he thought it was.
See, Larry, I think that's funny.
Well, it was funny, except for the person who was serving the prison time. It wasn't funny to them.
Definitely not funny. All right, I don't mean to make fun at you, Rocky. I'm sorry, but all right, let's move on to a question that is a true story. Chance, the person did have a polygraph at home when the handlers came back around.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, I am from Illinois, and I love your podcast show, and I feel the need to speak with you, or maybe Chance, on matters of registration here in Illinois, and would welcome any help you can provide. I, too, do not always agree with Adele and Mark, which would be Adele Nicholas and Mark Weinberg, nor with Martin Koff. Yet, they all act like I'm beneath them, and others as well. Yet, I helped others to get their day in court, and they went home. Had to fight for my life as I had faced possible civil commitment and knew not to use any alleged ex post facto claims. Larry, you tickle me to death. Larry, this is the one person that thinks that you're funny. Larry, you tickle me to death with all of your wisdom. I get the laugh, sir. FYP, James.
Well, you got it right. That's why I put it in here, because, see, at least one person appreciates what's funny, even though you don't.
I don't find you funny, Larry. Not what you send me. I don't think that's funny what you send me.
Well, that's because you've got a warped sense of humor.
Maybe you're the one with the warped sense of humor.
Well, I just got an email here. And funny thing is, he sent it to an address I don't use very much. Don't know how he found it. Maybe I had contact with him years ago, but I don't monitor that account. And I just happened to see it. But I don't stay on that account regularly.
Gotcha. Well, what else do you want to talk about with this comment?
I think we've covered it sufficiently. But thank you, James. At least you have a good sense of humor.
All right.
I'm suggesting, speaking for Chance, that if he wants to talk to Chance about Illinois, I'm sure Chance will. But remember, he doesn't practice there, nor do I conduct my unauthorized practice of law in Illinois. So anything that we would tell you should be taken with a little bit of trepidation.
Well, I imagine, can you imagine anybody that listens to the show did not hear this news already?
Yes, I could imagine that.
Really? I can't imagine, because, God, like, I heard it 10 different ways coming in on the Discord server or in the affiliates list email, all kinds of different ways. Anywho, if you haven't heard, Harvey Weinstein, his rape conviction, and, like, really what kicked off the whole Me Too movement, his conviction was overturned. And that was just a handful of days ago. And so let's see, Mr. Weinstein what's going on with Mr. Weinstein that justifies the consumption of FYP's valuable time? And before you answer, you should know, Larry, that even though this came out, like, what, 2 days ago? I scoured through and intensely, I read all 77 pages of the opinion, which includes two dissenting opinions.
Well, you've already set it up. His conviction was overturned by the New York Court of Appeals, which I believe is their top court, even though they call it Court of Appeals. So I believe that this is the end of the line in terms of any of a further appellate review. So he has a new trial coming his way if the prosecution chooses to prosecute him again, which they will.
And maybe we will cover this. Does this mean, like, the door's open and free? He goes, I don't want to talk about California. I'm just saying he walks out of the building?
No, not at all. Oh. There's too many machinations that have to go down before that. He's got a detainer that would keep him from leaving if everything else went perfectly, because he's got a conviction in California, and okay, they would hand him off to California. But also the machinations of this, he's not going to get to walk out until this process is complete.
I see.
There's a reconsideration that could be requested. It was a 4-3 opinion. There's the mandate has to issue, and then they have to figure out what kind of appeal bond they're going to grant him. There's a lot of things. I mean, Chance could probably more eloquently speak to it than I just did, but it's not like that they're running around with a key ready to let him out. That's not happening.
I see. All right. Well, then we will continue. So on page 2 of the opinion, it states, under our system of justice, the accused has a right to be held to account only for the crime charged, and thus allegations of prior bad acts may not be admitted against them for the sole purpose of establishing their propensity for criminality, nor may the prosecution use prior convictions or proof of the prior commission of specific criminal, vicious, or immoral acts other than to impeach the accused credibility. I've heard you mention many times there are exceptions to this provided by Rule 404B. By the way, can either of you please dig into what this rule means?
Well, I could, but I'm going to defer to a real attorney to keep my...
That's why we got him here anyway.
Detractors happy.
Me? Me.
That's you, the guy with the Esquire.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about it a little bit, since I must. From the federal perspective, 404B evidence is evidence of prior bad acts that the prosecution can introduce in their case in chief. Under federal rule of evidence, commonly abbreviated as FRE 404B, the prosecution is able to introduce evidence of defendant's prior bad acts that are not charged in the instant criminal case. Although introduction of 404B evidence is not permissible to show an individual's criminal propensity or predisposition to commit crimes, it is admissible for other reasons.
And what are some of those reasons?
Well, you know, 404B provides that prior act evidence, again, quote unquote, is not admissible to prove the character of a person in order to show action in conformity therewith, but it is admissible for several other purposes. Specifically, FRE 404B evidence can be admissible for purposes such as, and this is the list, proof of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident. And that's I mean,
isn't that a list?
But you know, it's a pretty comprehensive list.
Now, you have referenced the federal rules of evidence, as you said, FRE. Since this case was tried in New York, do they have a similar rule?
They do, which actually comes before the federal rules of evidence. The New York State has a similar provision, however, under a different name. Under a criminal case from 1901, titled People of the State of New York, it's the Molyneux case. Okay. The prosecution is able to make what's called a Molyneux application. And its purpose is identical, really, to the FRE 404B. However, the difference is that FRR 404B comes from a statute, while New York's Molyneux application comes from judicial opinion on a criminal case, which simply means that the exceptions can be expanded. It's non-exhaustible. As a result, prosecutors can get very creative in their arguments in applying Molyneux.
How is the notice and application done to admit 404B evidence?
Well, in the federal sense, the prosecutor can make an FRE 404B application as a motion in limine before the trial. The reason why a 404B application is made before trial is to give both sides an opportunity to present their arguments to the judge as to whether the FRE 404B evidence should be presented at trial.
Now, Larry, since the time of Jesus, you've been complaining about this kind of thing. So what is the standard for admissibility of 404B evidence?
Well, you're right. I've been complaining for a long time because there's judicial discretion, and whether to admit under 404B is within the discretion of the trial judge. But in order to decide, there's a test that the court must consider in determining whether such evidence is admissible. And to make that determination, if uncharged crimes or other bad acts would be admissible at trial, the court must consider the most important things that they must consider is the evidence of the uncharged crimes was offered for a purpose and it is relevant to a disputed trial issue. Meaning, in other words, if you just want to show that the guy's bad, doesn't come in. If you're trying to draw a connection to a disputed issue, and I'm going to give my own self as an example in a moment, but that's when it's that's the first prong of the test. And if you get past prong one, then you've got to do a second evaluation on whether its probative value substantially outweighs the possibility of significant prejudice to the accused person. And that's where the system breaks down, because you can generally get past hurdle one, and then there's enormous pressure on the judge to find it that it's not going to be too prejudicial to outweigh the probative value. But in an example, like on that non-exhaustive list that Chance read, I used to make thousands and thousands of prank telephone calls. I had an addiction that could not be overcome. I didn't want to overcome it, but I don't think it could have been at the time. And I had a particular method of how I did it. I liked calling universities and colleges that had phones in the housing units. And I would call sequentially from room to room. All you had to do is add a digit number to the previous number, and you were going to get someone, likely even the next room or two over. And I would do that. So, for example, if the police were unsuccessful in tracing the calls to me, but yet they had hundreds and hundreds of complaining people from within the university community that had received similar natured calls where the same thing was said by a person who did the same thing, going from door to from room to room number, and the person had the same type of soft Southern accent that I had, they could argue that you are correct, this is possibly prejudicial, but it's very probative because we're going to show that this is something that only this man has done. And all the history of us investigating prank phone calls, he's the only one who's done this. And this is a very unique MO to him. And therefore, we ask that you admit it. Now, in a case like that, Chance, if you were defending me, what would you say when the prosecutor moved to admit evidence under 404B that there had been 100 or maybe 200 phone calls to a particular housing unit on the University of Colorado campus, and we want to bring in some of these to testify that your guy did it, what would you say?
Ouch.
But
wow.
Would that be a very appropriate use of 404B?
Well, no. Of course, it's going to be more prejudicial than anything else. It's going to so outweigh any probative value that it's just not going to come in.
So you think the judge would deny that? Because I think that it never happened. I never had a prosecutor threaten that, but I thought they could make a compelling showing that we need to tie these calls to this person, and what he does is very unique. But that's an example.
I mean, I mean, you know, I mean, the fact is that you're right about that second prong, and, you know, that's where most of the mistakes are made. And, you know, if it's too prejudicial, then you get results like, you know, the Weinstein reversal. But, you know, there's also stacking and everything else. You know, what's the probable outcome? Some will come in and most will stay out.
Well, so let's say that a jury hears 404B evidence during a trial. What prevents the jury from misusing that evidence and convicting a person just simply because they do not like what they've heard?
Nothing. And therein lies the danger. The jury does hear a limiting instruction prior to beginning of deliberations. And it's something to the effect of 404B evidence that was presented by the prosecutor was presented for a limited purpose, namely to explain motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, and absence of mistake or accident. The jury will also be told that they're not allowed to consider 404B evidence as proof of defendant's criminal propensity. That is to say that just because the prosecutor presented the evidence of defendant committing bad acts that are not charged in the instant indictment, the jury is not allowed to use the prior bad acts as proof the defendant committed the crimes. That's such a joke. That's kind of like when the jury is told to disregard something that they've heard.
Right.
I mean, you tell the jury, we're going to let 15 people come in here and say that he raped me, but you're to disregard any of that other than just, I mean, it's nonsensical, but go ahead.
Why wouldn't they, why couldn't, I don't understand why this exists as opposed to bringing in witnesses as actual evidence to testify.
Well, they did that in Weinstein's case, but they wanted to make sure that they secured a conviction. They had the actual complaining witnesses, but they brought in several that were not a part of the case. And I sounded the alarm bell then. Hey, this is dangerous stuff. This is a high-profile case. You know, this shouldn't be happening, but they did.
Well, let me ask it a different way, though. Is this just to have a lower standard of evidence to just get something in the jurors' ears?
It's to win the game. Play the clip. This is to win the case. That's why they do
yeah,
it.
Andy, think of it like this. Think of it like this. You can't say he did that, so we did, you know, he did that, so we did this. You can say he did that, so he's the type of person who could do something like this. What's the difference?
Yeah, I gotcha. All right. Wow, I have screens moving all. Oh, dude, really? We gotta take a short pause. I'm gonna read my part. But anyway, the court stated defendant was convicted by a jury for various sexual crimes against three named complainants and on appeal claims that he was judged not on the conduct for which he was indicted, but on irrelevant, prejudicial, and untested allegations of prior bad acts. We conclude that the trial court erroneously admitted testimony of uncharged, alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than the complainants of the underlying crimes because that testimony served no material non-propensity purpose. So, this reversal is based solely on an error by the court?
Yes. Yes. What they're saying is there's no probative value. So they can retry him, and likely they will. The court went on to say the trial court compounded the error when it ruled that defendant, who has no criminal history, could be cross-examined about those allegations, as well as numerous allegations of misconduct that portrayed defendant in the highly prejudicial light. The synergistic effect of these errors was not harmless. The only evidence against defendant was the complainant's testimony. And the result of the court's rulings, on one hand, was to bolster the credibility and diminish defendant's character before the jury. On the other hand, the threat of cross-examination highlighting these untested allegations undermined defendant's right to testify.
Go ahead, Larry. I'm sorry.
Let me interrupt you. I hadn't even thought about that when I put this in here. Can you expand on that before we go to the next point about it undermined his the right to testify? Else we're going to leave that hanging. I think I understand it. But if he had testified, I mean, he did testify, if I recall right, but he would have been put in a very bad position. So, Chance, what does that mean about this undermined his right to testify?
Well, because it focuses not just on the act he's being alleged to have committed, but he could be tested on all that stuff. Okay? And so, you know, it opens up just a whole Pandora's box of things that are just indefensible. It's just, you know, and you know, basically takes away from, you know, what the act in itself is. It just, how can I put it? It's just like piling on. Okay. And the stat gets so high, it's just impossible to deal with.
So then what is the remedy for this?
Well, according to the court, the remedy for these egregious errors is a new trial.
And before trial, the court granted the prosecution's application to admit certain testimony of uncharged crimes and miscellaneous bad acts as an exception to the Molyneux. As an exception to the Molyneux rule, prohibiting such evidence to establish defendant's intent and his understanding of the complainant's lack of consent. Is that the application you referred to earlier?
Yes.
So then the three Molyneux witnesses testified about defendant Weinstein's unwanted sexual advances towards them. Witness one stated that she met the defendant in 2004 at a Manhattan nightclub while she was working as an actor, and the defendant said he could help her career. Sometime in 2004 or 2005, she met the defendant in a hotel room for a networking event. Defendant led her to the bedroom where he suddenly put his hand up a skirt and tried to put his hand inside her and apologize when she pulled away. A few weeks later, she agreed to meet him at another hotel where, clothed in a bathrobe, he told her that he would sign contracts for the work only if she had sex with him and his assistant, but then told her he was joking and said that she would never make it in this business unless she changed her attitude.
Yeah, can you imagine for a moment? Let's go back to, you know, Larry's question on the threat, you know, what we set up above, which was the threat of cross-examination highlighting these untested allegations of undermines the defendant's right to testify. If you've got to answer up for all those different things upon cross-examination, no one's going to want to testify because it's going to look like you've committed several crimes, and you know, before you know it, you're in way deeper than you were to begin with. So who's going to ever take the stand with so much at stake, not just what you're being charged with, but the potential of other crimes and other things hanging, you know, in the wings? What do you think, Larry?
Well, that's what I was trying to understand, because it seems like that he was in a no-win position, but I was thinking that he did testify despite this, but maybe he did not. One of our vast audience members will let us know. But he was deprived if he didn't testify, the way you've explained that. Who could testify if you're going to have a whole litany of people saying things that haven't gone through police investigations, no formal charges, no probable cause has been established, and they get to say all those things in a courtroom as if those things had been thoroughly tested and it met at least the minimum threshold showing a probable cause? That is sad.
Correct.
What happens next to him then? We talked a little bit, like, he won't get released, but this is overturning at least that he gets a new trial in New York. But if they did open the doors, he still has a conviction in another place, correct?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, the whole process starts from zero, square one again, in New York. But on the other hand, he's already been convicted on the West Coast, and that's not going anywhere. So, you know, no one's getting out. That's for sure.
Does this highlight that if you have essentially unlimited money, that you can fight the justice system to the almost to the point of breaking them down?
Larry,
I don't think so. I think first of all, I don't know that he has unlimited money. But I think this was such an egregious case of abuse by the prosecution that I almost would like to believe that the bar itself, the members of the bar, would have found this so repugnant that they would have stepped in to try to undo this, because this sets up doom for anybody, because it's, in this case, it's far bigger than Harvey Weinstein in terms of the ramifications of them being able to put you on trial for things that you were never accused of. So I think that it has very little to do with money. But as we were talking in pre-show, my fear is that legislatively, the pushback is going to be so enormous. There's already critics out there saying how this out of control, left-leaning, wacko Supreme Court of New York has done stuff like this over and over again, and that we need to do something to contain them. And I think the pressure will be so enormous on the New York Assembly that they won't be able to disregard this. They're going to have to try to pass some legislation. Don't know what it'll be, but they will come up with something.
I just want to go back around to the money thing. None of us would be able to get appeal after appeal after appeal, keep coming up with anything, like, because he, not unlimited money, but the guy at the time was worth $300 or something million when all this started.
Well, I don't think he's had appeal after appeal. I think this is a direct appeal. This is his first appeal, and you know, it's gone to the state's high court. I don't think that he's been, this is not like another person who's challenging everything over and over again. This is
who shall remain nameless.
Yeah, you're not talking about Crosby, are you?
Crosby or Cosby?
I'm sorry, Cosby.
No, we are not talking about him.
No. Okay.
We are talking about the man with the good hair.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I'll have to tell you later about the conversation I had with someone on Discord about what I said last week and the challenges that were brought to me because of it.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
But California Corner Time. Chance, take it away.
All right. California Corner Time. Last week, I received a submission from my website regarding the following question. Whether prison time for a sex offense could preclude an individual from relief under California's Certificate of Rehabilitation, under that statute, California's Certificate of Rehabilitation. Let me read the submission first, and then we'll get to the crux of the question. And here's what I got. I've obtained relief from yearly registration due to SB 384 and PC 290.5, as I was designated a Tier 1 offender, and I have the court order attesting to this. However, I would very much like to obtain a certificate of rehab as well. It has been 25 years since my convictions for felony non-aggravated PC 314, of which there are four. I've lived a law-abiding life since release from prison in 2004. The problem I see is the new SB 731 specifies that for any felony sex convictions, an expungement is not possible. PC 4852 indicates that one needs to expunge the convictions before applying for a COR. However, even before SB 731 passed, if one had served a prison sentence, it's my understanding that an expungement would not have been permitted. So SB 731 changed all this for non-sex offenses only. However, if you study 4852.13b, sub C, it seems to indicate that certificates have been obtained by sex offenders released from prison, as it states that the COR could be revoked if the felon has been subsequently deemed to be a danger to society. Okay, so to obtain a COR under this scenario, it may be a totally untested filing. I guess that would be helpful, to know whether or not there's any case law on the books that could support a request for a COR under PC 314 conviction that resulted in state prison. I had an attorney previously tell me that a COR is not possible for an ex-prison inmate convicted of a sex offense. I am wanting a second opinion.
Now, it seems like he has already achieved his goal, though. He didn't have to register in the state of California, even though he had been convicted of the same offense at least 4 times and served time in prison. What does he really want? What more can anyone ask for?
Well, you know what? Your dignity back? Redemption? What he really wants?
You want your time back.
Well, Sorry. You know, maybe, but you know what he really wants is the court to declare that he's rehabilitated. He has been removed from the California registry because he no longer poses a risk to community safety, but he wants complete relief under California law.
Well, I've got a question on that. I think that we can zero in on what complete relief might mean. Under a certificate of rehabilitation, if it were to be available to him, would that restore additional rights? What other relief would it provide? Like, for example, could he hold and could he run for it and be elected to public office? So what would complete relief look like?
Well, you know, no one really knows, but what we can say is I mean, it can help your chance of getting a professional license from the state board and be an official record that shows that you are officially rehabilitated, which may improve your job or housing opportunities. So it may go to your job you may be able to apply it to housing. Additionally, if granted, it's sent to the governor as your official application for a pardon, and that's automatic. Just that.
Okay, well, all these benefits sound great, but it looks like he has done the research and verified his conclusions with wise counsel that those are correct.
Now, wise counsel, really, Larry? Does that even exist today?
Well, that's a good question, Andy, and we're going to find that out right now. Now, let's see. Okay, let's break this down. Under PC Section 4850201, okay, which is where he should go in order to analyze this, and if you think about his message, it jumps around a bit, but, you know, just the front part of the statute is pretty clear. Under subsection A, it says, except as specified in sub B, a person convicted of a felony may file a petition for a certificate of rehabilitation and pardon pursuant to the provisions of this chapter, period. Now we go down to sub B, and sub B says, a person convicted of a misdemeanor violation of any sex offense specified in section 290 or a felony violation of any sex offense specified in section 290, who is granted probation. And, you know, let's just say that it's been dismissed pursuant to 1203.4, which is the dismissal statute, may file a petition for a certificate of rehabilitation and pardon pursuant to a few other things. Now, the operative thing about sub B is it talks about probation. So it doesn't mention prison time because that's contained in A. It specifically only applies to sex offenses where probation is granted. Therefore, for sex crimes where probation is granted, special conditions apply in terms of eligibility, such as a dismissal under Penal Code Section 1203.4. However, if you did your time in prison and were paroled, no such conditions apply, even if your conviction was a sex offense. Of course, this is a very simplistic analysis, but, you know, and there's other variables that may apply, but for the limited purpose of answering the question of whether prison time for a sex offense would preclude an individual from relief under PC 12 or PC 4850201, the answer is unequivocally no, unless your particular conviction is barred from relief under subsection 3. And there are some statutes, you know, some convictions that are. Anyways, gentlemen, your thoughts.
Well,
over my head.
I'm about as dizzy as Andy is when I explain some of this stuff with subsection A, B, and C.
Oh my God, dude, I can't read these things. It hurts my head so bad.
So can you, as Andy says, can you dumb it down? So if you get prison time, you are eligible for a certificate of rehabilitation, but if you get probation, you're not eligible. Is that correct?
No, no, you can be eligible either way. Okay. But, you know, here's the interesting thing. And I'm not talking about subsection C, because subsection C has certain convictions that you can't, whether probation's granted or you go to prison, you just can't get it. But, you know, forget subsection C for a minute. If you go to prison and you're paroled, you don't need a dismissal because you were never placed on probation. Therefore, you can apply without having to follow all those conditions under sub B. So you don't need any of that. And by the way, sub B has a few more conditions. Okay. It says, you know, if you're placed on probation, one, you need a dismissal. And two, you can file a petition if you have not been incarcerated in prison, jail, detention facility, or other penal institution or agency since the dismissal, since the dismissal was given. And you're not on probation, and, you know, a few other things, but none of that stuff applies to prison. I'm gonna tell you a story about a quick, brief story about an anomaly that happened in California before the tiered system happened. If someone was convicted of possession of child porn, and they were convicted of a misdemeanor after 2014, because in 2014. That particular conviction was barred from relief under the dismissal statute. So if you were placed on probation after 2014 for a misdemeanor, you could not get a certificate of rehabilitation. And that was bad because for that particular crime, if you got a certificate of rehabilitation, you were taken off the registry. However, if you were convicted and you went to prison for a felony and you were paroled, you were otherwise eligible for a certificate and you could be removed from the registry. Does that make sense?
Call the phone number that says Chance and he'll answer your questions. This is making me dizzy.
See, this is what happens when you write stuff, Larry, and I've got to read it and you're like, why don't you understand? I'm like, dude, I can read the words and I can make it sound coherent, but I didn't understand a word I said. That's exactly how this is the same thing.
Call the number on the board.
Call the number and Chance will walk you through it. But I can see what the writer of this is trying to accomplish, and I understand that part of it. But in terms of trying to dice this out, in terms of whether you could get relief or not, I don't think I could practice law in California. I'm not going to open my office there.
Yeah, I don't blame you. The simple answer is yeah, if you go to prison, you can. And yeah, if you get probation, you meet the conditions, you can. And so it does take an attorney to look at it and figure it out with you.
And the moral of the story is that call Chance at 494-365-5842. That's the moral of the story.
I like that moral. It's a very good moral.
Excellent. Well, Larry, we have some articles that you've left here for us. Shall we dig in?
Let's do it because we got three of them.
Okay. Well, from Courthouse News, there's an article from Los Angeles and it says the California Attorney General Wednesday announced criminal charges against a Los Angeles assistant district attorney accusing her of using information from a government computer without authorization. Deanna Taran, the assistant district attorney for ethics and integrity, faces 11 felonies after what Attorney General Rob Bonta said in a press release was an extensive investigation. She's accused of repeatedly using data from confidential and protected by statute peace officer files. Now, how does this relate to PFRs, Larry? Why is this in here?
Well, after reading it, I thought about it, and I'm cautiously optimistic that after 300 episodes of Registry Matters, that you and I can finally agree on something that's funny.
You had somebody at the beginning that was funny. This is not funny.
Based on this being an assistant district attorney in charge of ethics, this, you have to admit this is funny, right?
It's super ironic. And I may go that this is not, it's not funny, Larry. It's not funny.
Okay. Well, how far could you go since it's not funny? What would you concede?
It's intriguing.
Okay. You're hopeless.
I probably.
if you can't see that having the person in charge of ethics now having been indicted is funny, there's absolutely no hope. But anyway, according to the AG, Turan didn't have permission when she accessed a computer or computer network taking information from it. No one is above the law, but Bonta said in a statement. Public officials are called to serve the people and the state of California with integrity and honesty, and the California Department of Justice. We will continue to fight for the people of California and hold those who break the law accountable. End of quote.
Now, Taryn is accused of tapping into computer data which included many confidential peace officer files while serving as a constitutional policing advisor at the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department in 2018. She then is thought to have used that data after joining the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office in January of 2021.
And you can't even admit that's funny, can you?
No, I cannot.
Okay. District Attorney George Gascon said in a statement, quote, when I took office, we developed a protocol that ensured we complied with our constitutional obligations under Brady, which requires us to turn over potential exculpatory evidence to the defense at a category that includes law enforcement's prior misconduct, while simultaneously complying with the state and federal law around privacy. Now, I don't know what the relevance of that statement was, but I put it in there because it came from the district attorney himself.
Now, what would you have done differently,
well,
though?
I mean, clearly we're looking in the rearview mirror. But if I appoint someone to be in charge of ethics and integrity, I would make that appointment only after careful consideration of the person's own ethical behavior. And the article states that Taryn served in a handful of roles since joining the DA's office over 3 years ago. She began as a special advisor to the district attorney on post-conviction review, compliance with issues involving evidence and justice system integrity. In that role, she was considered part of Gascon's executive management team. Taryn then served as director of prosecution support operations before assuming the role of assistant district attorney. Now, you would think that Gascon would have been able to observe her and ask enough questions and watch her ethical conduct and determine if she was ethical. Now, chance she'd been practicing law for 30 plus years. Is it hard to determine if a prosecutor acts ethically? You've been on the other side of prosecutors for a long time. Is it difficult to figure out who exercises their responsibility under the code of professional conduct and the special role of ethics that prosecutors?
Not really. But I mean, you know, think about this though. You know, what Gascon said, he, and you just said, I don't know what this has to do with anything, but think about what he said. When I took office, we developed a protocol and we ensured we complied with our constitutional obligations under Brady. And, you know, Brady just says that, you know, you've got to turn over stuff that's exculpatory to the defense, like, you know, bad acts. We were just talking about bad acts by police officers and so forth. They recruited her from the very source they were digging into. And everybody knows that the police department stonewalls and makes it impossible for that information to get to the defense. And she shortcut it. So when you look at what Gascon's saying, he is backing her play. And he's saying, look, you know, there's a real tension between, you know, what we're asked to do, what we can do, and how we can do it. And that's going to be the complexity of this case. I see where that's going. And I'm not sure whether it gets into ethics and integrity, maybe, but there's a whole lot of folks here that are lacking integrity in the system, not just the person digging into that, you know, those resources when they shouldn't be.
There's an angle in here for the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I don't know if I have that whole code titled correctly, but there's, if you're not allowed to access systems that you're not allowed to have access to.
Correct.
Well, Chance, will you keep us apprised of how this case unfolds since it's in your neck of the woods?
I sure will.
All right.
And moving along then over to Reason Magazine. Oh, gosh. She only served 10 months behind bars. Florida still slapped her with a $127,000 bill. This is going to be another one that you say is funny, right, Larry?
I probably will.
All right. So under Florida's law, it's a pay-to-stay law. Inmates are charged $50 for every day of their sentence, including time they never... How does that work? How including time they never spent incarcerated? How does that work? Did I read that right?
You
Looks
did.
Like.
Now, imagine you've just been released from prison in Florida. You have every intention of turning your life around, and you plan to stay out of trouble and get a job and follow the rules of your parole. Then you find out you owe a six-figure bill. Now, can you try to admit that that's sort of funny anyway?
It's certainly not if you're the one that gets the $127,000 bill and you're making minimum wage. No, it's not funny. And just like the previous story from California, this is also not funny.
There's just no hope for you, I'm afraid. After 300 episodes, I'm going to let go of it. But according to the article, Florida charges prisoners $50 for every day of their original sentence, meaning they keep getting charged even if they're released early. When former inmates inevitably fail to pay this massive bill, it can prevent them from ever moving on from the period that they spent behind bars.
And couldn't that also then end you up in debtor's prison where you have a fine and then they lock you up because you have a fine, like if you're not paying child support?
I don't think it'll do that, but it certainly could cause you a lot of problems with your credit rating. Yep. And with job approval, a lot of employees these days look at your credit as one of the conditions for how reliable you are as a human being and an employee.
This is insane. All right. Well, quote, where I'm at today, I'm truly being stopped by one single barrier, and it is a dollar sign, Shelby Hoffman told WFTS Tampa Bay, a local news station. Hoffman was hit with a $127,000 bill for a 7-year prison sentence, even though she only served 10 months. Since her release from prison, Hoffman has gotten clean and rebuilt her life. She's soon to graduate with a bachelor's degree. However, she can't start her dream career as a case manager because of her outstanding pay-to-stay bill. Now, does this make any sense?
Apparently it does to the voters of Florida. Pay-to-stay fines end up following people like Hoffman long after they've left prison, trapping them with insurmountable debt. Not only is this practice cruel, but it obviously has little utility beyond the extended punishment of former offenders.
Yeah, I noticed that this article was from the ABA, asking those caught up in our criminal justice system to support government agencies as an inefficient way for the government to raise revenue. Lauren Brooke Eisen wrote last year in Human Rights, the American Bar Association's magazine, because many low-income people can't pay their debt. Billions of dollars in fines and fees go unpaid every year.
Well, we think it's unconstitutional, said Lisa Foster, co-executive director of Fines and Fees Justice Center. And she said that to WFTS in Tampa Bay. Quote, it's not a proportionate either to the underlying offense or to the person's financial circumstances.
Now, you know, it's interesting, the turnabout of Hoffman's grandmother. She is quoted as saying, I had a mindset because my dad was a federal prison guard that you do the crime, you know, you do the time. But when I actually lived through this, I thought, this is not the way it is. There's no compassion shown to anybody who makes a mistake and pays the price for it. And she did.
Isn't it interesting that people have these epiphanies of things that they've accepted as being good and cool when it's applied to them? But have you noticed when it's applied to you? Now that it's applied to her granddaughter, magically, she's been able to think it through more carefully. But this is ridiculous to charge somebody. If you can make a credible case for charging for the days that they spend in prison, you're providing their care. How can you make any compelling argument that you should charge for the 7 years that she wasn't, for the six of the 7 years that she wasn't there?
It's ridiculous.
Do any other states charge you for being locked up like that?
I've never heard of it.
I think it's on the books in other states. I don't think they make it a higher priority to try to collect it. I know during my time here in Albuquerque, we had a mayor named Martin Chavez, and Marty wanted people to pay for their time in local lockup, and they started billing people, I think it was $40 a day, and they dismantled the practice when they discovered they were spending more on their collection efforts than they were recouping, and they realized...
I could see Arpaio doing this.
I could see him doing anything, but thankfully his political career is over.
unfortunately. Well, then moving along back to the Associated Press. this article states nearly all inmates have been transferred out of a troubled women's prison set to be shut down in, hey, Chance, it's your back door again, in California. And U.S. senators on Wednesday demanded an accounting of the rapid closure plan for a facility where sexual abuse by guards was rampant. Now, what is all this about?
Well, this is one of those situations where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If the prison was as bad as the allegations, it needed to be closed. But members of the Senate Judiciary Committee sent a letter to the Bureau of Prisons expressing concerns over claims of a chaotic transfer process during which inmates were placed on buses and planes and they didn't receive proper medical care and were reported subjected to mistreatment, harassment, neglect, and abuse while in transit.
Susan Beattie, a lawyer for the inmates who blew the whistle on the conditions at the prison, said there were reports that during transport guards made abusive comments to the women, labeling them as snitches, referring to the closure of Dublin. In addition, the inmates were shackled at their wrists and ankles for the entirety of their long journeys, despite their minimum security classification, and in some cases were denied water and trips to the bathroom. Look, man, I have put up with that crap for a long time. You get shackled without a lot of bath breaks. Don't you remember that article we covered forever ago about the prison transport van? And you'd be on the van for 36 hours and they'd never let you off, no air conditioning. And you get thrown like a packed lunch and you got to eat it. And people were sitting on the floor getting peed on.
I've heard that. I remember that. A 2021 Associated Press investigation exposed a, quote, rape club culture at the prison, where a pattern of abuse or mismanagement went back several decades. The Bureau of Prisons repeatedly promised to improve the culture and environment, but the decision to shutter the facility represented an extraordinary acknowledgement that reform efforts had failed.
Ooh, you know, following the sudden announcement April 15th that the FCI Dublin would be shut down, U.S. District Court Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers ordered a case-by-case review of each inmate's specific needs before the transfers began. In response, the Bureau filed court papers questioning the authority of the special master appointed by the judge on April 5th to oversee the prison, who was tasked with reviewing each woman's status. Inmate advocates hoped the judge's decision would slow the shutdown, but the Bureau proceeded with the process anyway, saying in a court filing that extensive resources and employee hours have already been invested in the move.
And five Senate Judiciary Committee members on Wednesday asked Bureau of Prisons Director Colette Peters to provide information on preparations to close the facility and guidance given for the safe and humane release from custody or transfer of individuals to other Bureau of Prisons facilities.
Now, tell me, though, what will be the result of all of this attention from U.S. senators?
Absolutely nothing. This will pass and soon be forgotten. These people will be in their new institutions. There'll be those that were eligible for release, that were close to being released, will be put in. They were kept at Dublin, some that were close to being released. They'll be put in their halfway houses. The facility will be shut down, and it'll be long forgotten, and nobody will be thinking about it anymore. I don't think anything's going to happen to the Bureau of Prisons. They do what they want.
Just like the riot, whatever, in Mississippi a handful of years ago, like nobody talks about that anymore either.
Correct. I don't understand everything that's going on at Dublin. I don't understand how something as complex and sophisticated and as well-funded as the Bureau of Prisons can have a facility that has that much abuse and mistreatment happening. But if they couldn't fix it, it needed to be closed.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen somewhere else.
Well, you know, there's something to be said about sweeping stuff under the rug, I guess.
And yes, FCI means a federal correctional institution or corrections institution. Somebody asked in chat real quick. Anything else before we kick this down the road?
I think we've done it and we did perfect time. We've got a minute to go.
We do. I'm going to check real quick if we have any patrons. You and Chance talk for a moment.
We didn't get any paper subscribers, but we are going to build that. I know that in 2024, we're going to triple by the end of the year. I have faith.
It's going to happen.
Well, it can only get better now that we have the real Chance Oberstein on the show.
I thought it was like a product of AI. You think? I don't know. I've got to pinch myself, but I can't see anything.
You're a product of AI? Are you an AI? Are you an AI chatbot on the program now?
Yeah, I'm an AI chatbot. Something like that.
Well, very well. Make sure that you head over to registrymatters.co to find the show notes. And then you could also then head over to a phone if you want to, 747-227-4477, to leave a voicemail. Send me messages that I will forward to Larry and Chance at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, please head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. And I did all that. And then for as little as $1 a month, you can support the program and all of the work that we do here and all the many, 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 many hours that we spend putting this whole thing together for your listening enjoyment. Without further ado, Larry, I hope you have a great weekend and enjoy your event this evening. You're not going to stick around for very long, but you have an event to go to.
I do. So good night.
Good night. And Chance, as always, it's a pleasure having you, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.